Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast desperately seeking something to talk about that isn't Brexit. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
And we are also joined by Labour candidate for Spark Hill and Momentum South Birmingham and I can't even say it, it's cursed. And Momentum South Birmingham activist Nikki Brennan. Hey, Nikki.
Hi.
Now, it's been quite a week. Israel's been firing on unarmed protesters. Young teenagers are being killed in London on a far too regular basis. Donald Trump is existing. But it's going to be all right, guys, because we're going to be saved because David Miliband is coming back.
Hooray, Banana Man has come back to save us.
Actually, what has led to this week is Tim Shipman, who's the Sunday Times journalist, wrote All That War. He said that David Miliband is the rudest politician he's come across in 14 years of coverage. And the anecdote that apparently proved it this week is that Shipman asked David Miliband if he wanted a drink, and Miliband said yes, and Tim Shipman goes off the bar. As soon as Shipman goes, Miliband is slagging Shipman off behind his back, literally 10 feet away. Apparently also in the leadership contest, James Forsyth was saying that David Miliband only needed four more MPs to give him a second preference to be Ed, but he couldn't be bothered phoning them up because he assumed they'd vote for him anyway and didn't need to campaign for them. Speaking of making friends and influencing people, we're not going to talk about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party either. We're going to do that in our midweek shot on Wednesday and probably in a few other podcasts as well, in between our tiers. What we're going to speak about instead, though, we're going to try and talk about what the government is doing rather than what the opposition is saying. So we're going to talk about the national government and the Tories, and we're going to talk about local government in Birmingham as well, because Birmingham Labour has a manifesto out, which is exciting. We'll do all that after this. That was almost professional.
Almost.
Steve, it feels to me like this week the media's done a reset with Theresa May. We've gone back to the stoic, solid, safe pair of hands just getting on with the job. And it's almost like they've forgotten the last 2 years have happened.
Yeah, well, essentially what's happened is the media have done their normal thing. They've reached the end of a story of Theresa May, the hapless Prime Minister, and have tried to find something new to spin with the events that happened in Salisbury, with the Novichok, and the fact that Theresa May has actually had an alright crisis and has had some actual victories there on the diplomatic scene. More on that later. She's been able to present herself actually as a bit more competent, which gives particularly the right-wing press the ability to play her up as, again, this strong and stable, important
Start repeating the Tory attack lines. We've been through this before.
I know, my apologies. But especially when you compare it to the way that Corbyn was handling the crisis as well, his, in some instances, less than ideal way of responding to things, purely from a political point of view, it becomes very easy to see why they've kind of made that switch and have started talking about Theresa May as a winner again.
Do you think this will change when she starts campaigning for the locals again and she'll give the same answer to all of the local newspapers and to every single question that she's asked?
Well, here's the thing, actually. When you pay attention to some of the little bits and pieces that she's been doing recently when it comes to campaigning and all of that, she seems to have gotten better at that. There have been a couple of cringeworthy moments still, but she genuinely seems to be getting better at dealing with people. I suspect the... Yeah, I suspect the...
Better than the worst campaigning Prime Minister ever.
I'm not saying it's a high bar to get over, but I do think they've probably taken some of the lessons from the 2017 general election and have decided to give her some training to actually get around it so that it's at least not as bad as it was previously.
See, I don't think she looks comfortable in her own skin, so she just doesn't see people as real people. And I think because she stays away from actual normal people and she lives in this kind of bunker of Westminster and stuff, I don't think she's going to be a very good campaigner even in the locals.
No, it's weird. She just seems to be randomly turning up on Conservative doorstepping teams, and no media will be there, but there'll be a selfie with some Tory activists, and you go, I mean, that's kind of nice, but also it's weird that the Prime Minister's essentially just being used as an extra door knocker.
I mean, given how things went during the general election, that might be the all they feel they can use her for at the moment.
Very, like, stage managed.
Hmm. Yeah, just give out the posters. So May is trying to get a legacy, though, which, as we know, is not going to happen because Brexit is what she'll be remembered for. Whether it goes well, whether it goes badly, spoiler, it goes badly. Brexit's all she's going to be remembered for. But there are two areas she's trying to get a legacy in. One of them is the trying to address the gender pay gap. So May wrote an article for, I think, the Telegraph this week saying that the gender pay gap was an injustice that needed to be addressed.
I find it very difficult as a woman and a feminist to take Theresa May's opinions on gender pay gap seriously at all, especially as she attacks women so much with her policies. So I don't see her as a sister or somebody that speaks for me in any way, because I think the poorest in society, which are often women, who are doing these jobs like care, looking after children, that kind of work isn't seen as a priority to this government, being as we've had so many benefit cuts and things. I just kind of don't think that talking about women in these high-powered jobs getting a bit more money is actually going to address gender pay gap at all.
Yeah, I think that's actually quite an interesting point, is that an awful lot of the attention when it comes to like the gender pay gap stuff does basically fall onto, you know, that notion of middle class success. Yes. It's all about your worth is being defined by your salary packet. Mm-hmm. And certainly for, at the very least, people who are carers, people who are the lead parent in a household in some form, they aren't probably going to be making as much of a salary. And then it just does suggest that if we're measuring worth by salary, that those people are therefore worth less.
And I think looking at things like maternity, I don't think women get enough maternity leave, they don't get enough maternity pay. It's a gap out of your career. You go back, maybe a man's doing your job. Employers don't want to employ you at a certain age because you might have a child. I've had employers ask me about how I'm going to cope, where are my children going to go when I've gone for an interview. Thankfully, I work for a women's company now, and like a women's organisation, and they're very good with that thing. But it's something that's always in an employer's mind. You're 25 years old, you're going for a job, you might have a baby, you might need maternity leave, we'll employ this man instead. And I think that's a massive block for women working too.
Mm-hmm. And that's especially the case actually when you start to move further up the ladder in businesses. I mean, I can't really speak to the public sector, but I can speak for the private sector, which is what I've worked in my entire life, my entire working life rather. And certainly as you get higher up that chain, that chain of command, there is more and more expectation that you will do stuff that's out of hours. You will do stuff which is more out of your remit, because it's just, you know, that's just how things work. And ultimately, if you're the primary caregiver or a primary carer for anyone, not just necessarily kids, it can be parents who are elderly and infirm or anything like that, you're not able to actually kind of make those commitments, which in turn holds you back, and you're there, and because there's probably going to be you know, someone like me who's single, male, and is quite happy to spend their free time in the evenings doing a bit of extra work. Yeah. I'm the person that gets the leg up versus somebody who's got kids.
Employ Steve in more top level roles. That's the takeaway I'm getting here.
Not quite what I meant, but
okay. I mean, it's those structural issues, though, isn't it? It's the structural issues of maternity pay, care, the fact that a lot of women end up working part-time because of that as well.
Also, childcare costs. So if you look at a nursery cost for your child, you're basically going to work to pay for somebody else to look after your child, and you might make an extra £20 a week. So a lot of women kind of don't see the point of going back to work, which isn't a good society to be in at all.
A good job, then, that Theresa May's government is investing in early years education to...
I mean, and again, this is one of those areas where actually I feel like Labour could do an awful lot in kind of moving the debate onwards. Currently, I don't think they are. I mean, recently Angela Rayner has announced we're going to have this consultation of some sort on the National Education Service, quote unquote, as it's been dubbed. Universal nursery provision would be a very good way to actually help probably actually address a lot of the gender pay gap that does exist in some areas. Because it would mean women could get more easily back into work, which means they're not having to have as much time off. And, you know, they don't necessarily fall behind, quote unquote, in terms of the experience they have, which is currently where an awful lot of that that pay gap comes from, other than, you know, fewer people at the top of the pyramid being women.
So I look at my friend that's trying to apply for work now, and she had her daughter, and she's had to go from like a manager of a company, and she can't even get jobs working on like the shop floor anymore because they won't employ her because she's got a child. And we're talking about a new shop that's open that doesn't have shift patterns, and they're telling her, no, we don't want you because we know you're not going to be flexible because you've got your daughter. And it's like stuff like that. It's just, she's had to go from this top salary completely back to the start. And she says herself, oh, motherhood's made me have more skills, it's made me be able to talk to people better, it's made me more organised. And like, employers aren't seeing this, they're just seeing a child as a problem, and that's not good.
Ultimately, an awful lot of the talk about changing the relationship we have with work is based around a very middle class and very office based mm-hmm. definition of what work is. It's brilliant for me, I work in an office, I can have my company's brought in flexi time, I can now adapt my hours to fit my life. But that doesn't necessarily, you can't do that if you're working on a shop floor, because ultimately the shop's open at certain times.
Well, the same for teachers as well. So coming from an educational background, and the especially with issues of teacher workload, it would make more sense to have part-time teacher roles and more job sharing in classes. But actually, I think schools are very reluctant to take on more part-time staff, which would seem to be a logical way of trying to kill two birds with one stone, I think. Okay, cool. That's that sorted. The other way...
Problem solved.
Just employ Steve. The other way Theresa May's trying to get a legacy is through NHS funding. And now Jeremy Hunt, who I think you picked as your politician to watch, or one of them to watch in 2018, apart from, you know, the NHS crisis, he's had a good year.
Yeah, he has so far.
Because he came out and he had an interview and he said, we need a long-term funding pattern for the NHS over 10 years. And then...
So it says something about the state of the government, where a single successful interview which didn't go completely wrong is we can make a strong case for, isn't he doing well?
I see that, and I raise you Boris Johnson, and I will say actually that is a standard that not many cabinet ministers can hit at the moment. But then Theresa May came out, I think, when she was interviewed with all the select committee heads, and she actually said something that was meaningful, and she said, we need to have a sustainable long-term future for NHS funding over 10 years. And you think, well, I mean, you're right, but you've already been cutting social care by 1% a year. And as you've said before, Nikki, it's those kind of jobs often done by women that, especially with an ageing population, we really, really need. But it's also the fact that we seem to think we've had 55,000 operations cancelled this winter. We've had the BMJ seem to think there were 10,000 additional deaths over the winter because... partly maybe because of the flu, but also because of the cuts, and 120,000 extra deaths over the last 2 or 3 years, essentially because of a nurse shortage, which we've talked a bit before on the podcast. That's kind of one of the vague Brexit effects going on. It feels to me like you've got a couple of things going on. One of them is that they've said so many times, or people like Boris Johnson have said so many times, that Brexit means we're going to get more money for the NHS. They've got to do something. But also, if Corbyn becomes Prime Minister, he'll become Prime Minister because of the housing crisis or public sector crisis in the NHS. And the government's, I think, trying to defuse that as an issue. Again, I just don't, I don't see anything really coming forward.
On that, the main thing the government needs to actually think about is you need to actually do something about it. It's all very well and good turning around and saying, oh yeah, we need a long-term 10-year funding solution for the NHS. It's all well and good, for instance, with Michael Gove in DEFRA saying, oh, we need to do this, that and the other to help improve the environment, to decrease plastics or whatever else. But, you know, talk is cheap. It's progress, don't get me wrong. It's very good, actually, that Jeremy Hunt and Theresa May have come to this conclusion that actually the NHS does need some more funding. Brilliant. Thanks a lot, guys. We could have told you that 3 or 4 years ago, but you've gotten there eventually, so well done you. But you need to actually act on it, because otherwise you're just, you know, it's just hot air. And that is currently where the government is falling down, because they can't act on anything. Even the things that are really important to the Brexit debate, such as, say, the immigration bill, that keeps on getting put on the back burner and pushed down further and further into the year. And that's happened time and time again with a number of different issues related to Brexit. Then they're bringing up this sort of stuff where, again, lots of nice words, but failure to actually act. And that failure means it's worthless. There's nothing actually there to do. So unless they come up with solid proposals, well, it's very good that you're saying this, Jeremy Hunt and Theresa May, but, you know, why should we pay attention unless there's an actual plan?
I think the plan's to privatise, though. I don't think there's any kind of plan to save the NHS. I think it's just words to kind of keep people afloat with voting Tory. And I think their long-term goal is to privatise the NHS and to have an American healthcare system. And I think that's the way we're going with the government at the moment.
I think there's some people in the Tory party who, I think, is it Oliver Letwin, I think, is on record, yeah. I think, is saying stuff like that. I don't know if that's true necessarily of Theresa May, only because I think Theresa May seems to be that kind of very old-fashioned home counties, you know, Daily Mail style, yeah. The NHS is our religion. But I think there's enough people in the Tory party, Jacob Rees-Mogg, who would probably be quite happy with that.
Yeah, I think you probably are going to continue to see more of a push towards privatisation in the NHS, but I don't think it's actually necessarily going to end up towards that American-style healthcare provision. Because I think ultimately, any government that tried to take away the notion that healthcare was free at the point of need in this country would get eviscerated. There is a reason we refer to the NHS as the national religion. Hell, we put it in the middle of our Olympic ceremony, opening ceremony, and everybody really loved it, apart from a couple of Tories, who incidentally are the ones who would happily see that American system brought in. So, and I don't think Jeremy Hunt and Theresa May are that suicidal when it comes to politics. I think they both have ambitions and
money
plans.
Money talks, though, doesn't it?
And Theresa May would never make any ill-advised proposals on social care.
Oh, no, never.
Never.
No evidence of that at all.
No. I am reminded of what Tony Blair did when there was an NHS funding problem, which is just go on David Frost and say we're going to have this extra much money for the NHS, and Gordon Brown just had to do it. All those people who've tuned in because of Momentum South Birmingham have probably switched off now, haven't they? Praise for Tony Blair.
Idiot.
It's fine. Never mind. Moving on. Speaking of Tony Blair and ill-fated foreign interventions, the Novichok affair. That almost works as a segue. So this was an actual diplomatic success. So Theresa May had a good crisis. They coordinated with the EU, and the EU withdrew an ambassador to Moscow. And I think 14 of the EU countries withdrew diplomats.
25 countries in total withdrew, basically threw out diplomats from Russia. Diplomats in inverted commas, because apparently we all know they're spies, but no one's...
We've all seen the films, yeah. Steve.
There would have been more, but some of them, like New Zealand, looked really, really hard, but couldn't find any to throw out. Which is just totally adorable. So, yeah, it was basically a very good success on the international stage.
But even Trump's America, the American administration, also expelled diplomats. It looked good. And actually, the Tories saw a bit of an uptick in the polls because of how Theresa May handled it. And then Boris Johnson happened.
That seems to be just like a sentence you can use in everyday life, just to know. Just
and then
to know.
Boris Johnson happened.
Yeah.
It's just like, and then everything went wrong.
So, Porton Down were asked who made the sample, and Porton Down can't say specifically who made the sample.
Specifically, what we should say is that Porton Down were never tasked with the job of being able to say who made the sample. Their job was to actually say, this is Novichok, this is what we know about it, this could only have been made by a government or a state actor.
And... I mean, that would be fine if only Boris Johnson hadn't come out and said, I asked the guy myself, the guy at Porton Down, I said, are you sure? And he said, there's no doubt that it was the Russians who made the sample. And when you think that the whole point of Russia's disinformation campaign is to make you disbelieve things and make you not sure about what's true and what isn't true, it's not really very helpful for Boris to come out and say that something definitely happened when it definitely didn't happen.
But it's not like Boris has a history of lying just to make an interesting story, or, you know, lying because it's helpful for him at any given moment.
It certainly didn't happen when he was at the Telegraph Brussels correspondent in the 90s, did it?
No, not at all. He totally was covering things 100% accurately there. And it's not like he stuck a slogan on the side of a bus as well and said there'll be $350 million for the NHS and then backtracked very, very quickly on that once he ended up in a position where he might be able to influence it.
And he definitely wasn't sacked from the Times for making up a quote, was he? That was
no,
a different Boris Johnson.
It's a completely different Boris Johnson.
And it wasn't that Boris Johnson who had to resign from Michael Howard's shadow cabinet for lying about an affair either, was it?
No, it's completely different Boris Johnson.
Right.
And he's also quite racist.
Oh yeah, there's that
as well, yeah.
Is there anything else to say about this ridiculous man other than
Why?
Sack the man.
I don't understand why he's still in his position. It just shows how weak May is, that she won't get rid of him.
I think but almost scared of shadows now. Like, no, who's going to vote for Boris as PM? Like, Nadine Dorries, and that's probably about it.
Who wants to do it, though?
Yeah, there is.
This is genuinely the thing with this, is that it still demonstrates that even though Theresa May's position is much more secure than it was previously, and I don't think that's really in doubt, it is a lot stronger internally in the Tory party than it was before. She's still frightened of kicking things off again and her undermining herself. You know, I think she's terrified by the fact that maybe Boris can apply some of that old school charm that he had before if he's thrown out of the cabinet. But the reality is, I think he's blotted his copybook with far too many of his colleagues in the Parliamentary Conservative Party to ever really stand a chance at getting into the final two ballot to the members. So I don't think he is a threat anymore. I think just Theresa May's just become scared and paranoid and doesn't want to rock the boat because, well, she's tried rocking the boat before a little bit and it went disastrously for her.
It reminds me almost that it's a little bit like subprime mortgages almost, in that it's, like we said at the start, the media narrative now is good and there's confidence there, but I don't think it'll take very much for that confidence to go away. I think there's a story in The Spectator this week that they expect the Tories to get wiped out in London. And if there are big Labour gains in London, in Manchester, in Birmingham, and the Tories lose a few of their flagship councils, I think suddenly Theresa May will seem a little bit more weak and wobbly. And I think that's the thing, is a lot of it is still built on sand at the moment, or a lot of it is built on the DUP. And what happens with the Irish border?
I mean, that's another can that's being kicked down the road at every possible opportunity, so...
Yeah, that's Westminster government, but we are at the moment in a Birmingham local election campaign, which is very exciting. I'm definitely not drinking heavily as a result of that election campaign. And Birmingham Labour Group has a manifesto out, and it talks about municipal socialism, which is kind of nice, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, I suppose if you're into that kind of thing.
For instance, in Birmingham, you've got stuff like... Now that the contracts will be in-house preferred. So it was before that Birmingham City Council were intensely relaxed about outsourcing, and it's now in-house preferred. They've also specifically cited the Preston model, and we've talked about that before. Mm-hmm. I think John McDonnell has been quite good on the Preston model as well, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And so the whole idea is that you try and buy local, so you try and recruit and invest in your in Preston or in Birmingham around that local area, rather than trying to outsource it to bigger companies. And also building municipal water companies and municipal energy companies, which is very Joseph Chamberlain kind of municipalism. I think it's kind of interesting, particularly in Birmingham, where you've got, like, Birmingham traditionally is a bastion of the Labour right. It's that kind of old-fashioned right-wing trade unionist, quite left-wing in a lot of ways, but quite kind of socially conservative. And the fact that they're looking to Preston, the fact that they've got quite a left-wing manifesto, I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is quite a bit of a step change. I'll say previous leaders of Birmingham City Council, but I don't think it is about the leaders. I don't think...
No, I think it's more of a national picture of the Labour Party, and we've seen Jeremy Corbyn's Labour do very well in a general election, especially in Birmingham, where a lot of the young people have come out and voted. And I think they're trying to kind of harness some of that, because that's what's going to make Birmingham Labour successful, looking at what the national picture's doing and thinking, yeah, we need to adapt some of this into our local politics.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would agree 100% with that. But I do think it's quite interesting the way they've gone about it, though, in terms of the kind of the policies that they're pushing forward. It would be very easy to just kind of go down a bit more of a, for lack of a better term, a reactive route, where it's just a few kind of headline policies that might be very appealing to those younger audiences that they want to get out. But instead, they seem to have gone to a lot more thought and effort into it than I otherwise might have thought. The fact that we've now I've put a focus on, you know, municipalism, going back to something that Birmingham was very, very good at in the past. And it was only after Thatcher basically seized control of a number of the Birmingham-owned companies and then privatised them without giving any money back to the city itself, that these things were lost in the first place. You know, there wasn't a single kind of like council, whether it was Tory, Labour, Liberal, or whatever, in Birmingham that wanted to get rid of those companies. You know,
you have to look at it realistically as well, because we haven't got a Labour government at the moment, so there's not a big pot of money to kind of be invested into services that we need, so they've kind of had to be quite clever with what we're working with. So obviously everything that Labour would want to do in Birmingham, they can't at the moment because we've had these massive cuts. So things like children's services and things and nurseries, they're not getting the funding that they need. And but I still think the manifesto is quite clever in what it's doing to try and harness this kind of socialism, but on like a budget at the moment.
I mean, that ultimately is one of the biggest challenges that the left has in any country, especially in Britain, though. It's very easy to do left-wing things when there's a lot of money going around. And obviously you can increase taxes and find other revenue streams and all that to increase that amount. But ultimately, you know, money is that constraining force. And I think actually where the interesting thing with a lot of the municipal kind of socialism stuff comes in is that it opens up potentially a lot of new revenue streams. Profits from things like, you know, water companies could be funneled back into the system, especially if you were to run them, say, as cooperatives. That, to me, is what I find quite fascinating about it. It's because it opens up a lot of... It's the start of a new way of thinking about funding for local government, which ultimately is the thing we need to be focusing on if we want to make local government work.
Focusing on different areas as well. So John Cotton, who's been on the podcast before, he's been quite active with Liam Byrne. Sadly, John's not been able to get Liam to shave his beard, which is a shame. But what we have been quite good at is getting together that homelessness manifesto and being able to tackle that with Sharon Thompson as well. And it's really great to see some practical steps being taken on that particular area as well. And it does seem symptomatic of the wider direction in the Labour Party as well. And it reminds me of what was said about, I think, about Barry Goldwater losing the Republican election in 1964. And they said, well, that Goldwater won the 64 election. It just took them 16 years to count the votes when Ronald Reagan came up with similar ideas in 1980. And I think a similar direction will happen in the Labour Party. Although Labour didn't win the 2017 election, I think the direction of travel in the party is less managerial in local government and is becoming more activist solutions. And I think, to be fair, that's good for everyone.
Yeah, because previously managerialism, you know, was a solution to some problems a while back, but it's not the solution to where we are now.
It's very off-putting managerial style, I find, when you look at like politicians that are quite managerial. It doesn't kind of grasp in working class people into politics. It really alienates everybody, I think. Mm. And it kind of leaves politics to like the select few that feel like they can be managerial.
We done? Hurrah! Wow. If you want to read other stuff, we have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. We have our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. And James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. Dave Deppert is responsible for our logo, Plucky Good Times. My Twitter handle is Paperback Rioter.
And mine's at Centre Radical.
And mine's Nikki E. Brennan.
Happy plotting, everyone. But it's very Joseph Chamberlain. He's everyone's good idea of a municipal socialist. What?
He wasn't a socialist.
Didn't he call it municipal? I can't remember.
He wasn't a socialist.
He wasn't a socialist. He definitely
wasn't. He was not a socialist. No, he split both of the parties.
Well, yeah.
I'll do another.
And one, two, three, retake.